council are here, I'll let you get settled. And when you're ready to proceed, please state your name for the record before you start your argument. You'll each have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Perlmutter, and I am here on behalf of the appellants, AF Enterprises, George Ficicello, and Ashok Patel. The district court abused its discretion when it denied the defendant's motion to vacate under Rule 6002. Additionally, the district court erred in initially granting the motion for summary judgment in the first place. First, in regard to the 6002 motion, all four factors were met. As discussed in the brief, only the first two factors were truly at issue in the lower court decision. As such, although I will be discussing all four factors, I will be focusing most of my time on whether or not the defendants had a debatably meritorious defense, and if the defendants had a reasonable excuse for their failure to defend against the motion for summary judgment.
Do you agree that all four offending factors need to be established in order for the motion, the Rule 60 motion, to be granted?
Yes. There are cases that have indicated that it's more of a balancing test, but I do believe that all four factors need to be established, and I also believe that all four factors are established within this case. Turning to the debatably meritorious defense, this factor is satisfied if there is specific information that clearly demonstrates the existence of a debatably meritorious defense. A debatably meritorious defense was provided by trial court counsel in their initial pleadings, as well as the memorandum of law in support of motion to vacate default judgment. They pled equitable remedies, including equitable estoppel, detrimental reliance, unclean hands, latches, as well as issues with the contract governing the agreement.
Do you agree that to defeat summary judgment, and I guess to be more specific to the issue before us, the primary issue, which is the Rule 60 motion determination, a party has to come up with something more than the allegations of a complaint, correct?
Correct. However, it's the articulated standard for a debatably meritorious defense is if established. It doesn't actually have to be established. It just needs to be in existence.
What is the scope of our review? I mean, what are the documents? What's the evidence that we should be considering today? Not just the pleadings, but also, would you agree, the settlement document from the eviction case is part of our record?
I would agree that you could consider that as a part of this factor and this argument. I think that all documents in the case up until this point can be considered. I do think that the eviction matter was separate and apart from this case. However, obviously, it was part of the purview of the history of the parties, and as such, it could be considered.
And you would agree that a settlement agreement is a contract?
I would argue that it's a contract. Yes, I would.
And so what are we to do with paragraph one, where the parties stipulate and agree that they are settling only claims regarding the possession of the lease premises? Parties neither release or waive any contract claims under the lease or the, it says of, I think it means, or the lease guarantees. What do we do with that language?
I think that it's to be considered. But I also think that there were issues potentially with the contract that ruled the lease to begin with. Trial counsel did make those arguments. I think that it can go to what the parties believed as they were proceeding forward. However, I do believe that there are other defenses that could be considered within the separate lawsuit.
So you identify three primary defenses, is that correct? Unjust enrichment, promissory estoppel, and that the contract is unconscionable?
Yes.
And isn't unjust enrichment an affirmative claim, not a defense?
Correct.
And so how can that be a reasonable defense on the merits then?
I believe that...
And it, I'm sorry, just to clarify, there wasn't a counterclaim for unjust enrichment in this case?
No, but there were other counterclaims associated with, I believe, the security deposit and one other matter.
Correct, but it wasn't pled as a counterclaim, and you're arguing now it's a reasonable defense on the merits. So I guess I'm having trouble understanding how it's a reasonable defense.
I believe that we are speaking of promissory estoppel, correct?
No, the unjust enrichment claim.
Well, it is an affirmative defense. In paragraph 16 of the initial answer by trial counsel, he labeled multiple different theories and defenses and included kind of catch-all language, including but not limited to. As such, I would argue that...
But he didn't list unjust enrichment.
He did not list unjust enrichment.
And also, doesn't the case law establish where there's a contract, relief under a contract, that an unjust enrichment claim can't be brought?
Correct.
So, how does that, why are you arguing, or how are you arguing that unjust enrichment is a meritorious defense here?
My reliance on unjust enrichment as a meritorious defense is trial counsel's answer to, or his memo, trying to vacate the summary judgment. Additionally, beyond that defense, I do believe that there are other meritorious defenses at issue that could be addressed even if this is found not to be properly raised by trial counsel.
And those include promissory estoppel.
Promissory estoppel, unclean hands, detrimental reliance, equitable estoppel, issues with the contract itself.
And what evidence did you present as part of your Rule 60 motion to support those defenses?
Trial counsel provided evidence in his memo. His memo is not numbered. However, he does say... he goes through and talks about how, equitable estoppel fits with the appellants in this case because promises were made during the eviction dispute. He says
that... Is there an affidavit showing evidence of a promise?
No. However, again, these are claims, these are defenses that exist. They don't have to be established to satisfy this prong. They need to be out there. Again, the articulated standard is if established, confirming that a defense does not need to actually be established. And as such, trial counsel should have been given the opportunity to fully argue this case on the merits.
Doesn't the Charlson case establish that the claim must be demonstrated by more than just conclusory allegations? And in that case, there were underlying documents to support their claim of meritorious defense. So I guess I'm struggling to see that it's enough to just argue that these defenses exist. It seems to me that that's your position here, but correct me if I'm wrong.
I would argue that trial counsel made more than conclusory statements. I would also argue that during the hearing itself, he was able to flesh out some of these defenses more fully. I think that the trial court did make a mistake when they didn't find that there was enough to raise a defense. This was a case that should have proceeded on the merits, and he should have been allowed to fully try this case. Whether or not they would have won or not, that's not an issue. It's whether or not their case should have been able to be presented. So as such, I would argue that there is enough for this case to proceed on a debatably meritorious defense.
So let's look at the timing. Trial counsel was in Vietnam until February 9th.
Correct.
And the hearing itself was on February 21st.
Correct.
So any responsive filings for that motion, the trial counsel still would have had time once he returned to the U.S. to submit something within a timely fashion.
That is correct. And in his memo attempting to vacate the summary judgment, I believe that trial counsel did explain that he failed to go through all of his emails after he got back from Vietnam. There were multiple mistakes that trial counsel made. He went abroad. He didn't have internet service. He was extremely sick. He didn't go through all of his emails. He didn't go through all of his e-filing notifications. He, you know, didn't realize that there was this motion for summary judgment date established, that there was going to be a hearing on it, because I believe that it was set during a settlement conference or a conference, and it wasn't indicated on the order. So there were multiple failings by trial counsel in this case. However, they, you know, the clients themselves had a reasonable excuse for failing to appear to defend against this motion.
Because they didn't know about it.
They didn't know about it. They hired...
I understand that. That seems to be one of your strongest arguments, that we shouldn't, that the district court erred by assigning to your clients the error of their lawyer. Do you have a particular case that you rely on that would support our reversing on that ground?
I believe that I've briefed multiple cases that would establish reversing on that ground. I don't have a particular case off the top of my head, but I would rely on my brief.
It seems in your brief that you didn't identify any specific findings of fact that were erroneous in the judge's order. Is that right?
I think that the findings of fact in the judge's order were limited. I think that there were concise statements discussing how there were no debatably meritorious defenses and how they didn't have enough to find whether or not there was a reasonable excuse for the defendants not to appear.
So is that a yes?
That's a yes. Either way, I would argue that it is clear what the district court was thinking. Particularly, I mean, I think that we do have a very strong argument for the fact that defendants had a reasonable excuse. Yet the court did not find that for them at all. I believe that
counsel, certainly your clients can't be faulted, and it's unfortunate that the trial counsel didn't appear for the summary judgment hearing. But in the Cole case, the court did say that there's no per se rule requiring either the grant or denial of a Rule 60.02a motion under the reasonable excuse requirement. And the matter's largely within the discretion of the trial court. So how did the trial court abuse its discretion with regard to that factor?
I believe that they abused their discretion by not allowing our clients to be heard on the case, heard on the merits, allowing it to proceed. Even if they lose on this case, they are still entitled to their day in court. They're still entitled to provide a defense, and they're still entitled to make their arguments just like anybody else would have. If they had been allowed to appear for this motion, they would have been able to fully defend against it, and we might not be in this position today. So as such, we would ask that this case be reversed and remanded for the trial on the merits, and so that they may be fully held in the entirety of their lawsuit.
Well, would that be what you're asking, or would it be for reversal? I mean, would the respondent be entitled to seek summary judgment again if we agree with you that this should be reversed and remanded?
I would agree that they would be able to seek summary judgment again. I think that that the clients are entitled to have an attorney there to argue on their behalf and fully present their meritorious defenses at that motion for summary judgment, if that's how opposing counsel would like to proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honors. Christopher Grote of the Ballard's Bar Firm, here on behalf of respondent RNS Crossing. Respondent is also, I'll refer to them as landlord from time to time. The respondent respectfully requests that the decisions of the district court below be affirmed in all respects. There's two orders before you and two issues before you. The first one was whether or not the district court erred in granting summary judgment for the landlord on its affirmative claims for breach of contract, breach of guarantee, and for declaratory judgment.
Can we really assess that before we decide whether defendants had a right to be there and argue against summary judgment? I mean, I understand why you want to start there, because it does relate to the defenses and whether they're meritorious or not. But how do we say that? Because even when their facts are undisputed, there can be dispute about where those facts lead the court as a matter of law. And the fact that the defendant appellants here were unable to respond to the legal arguments in support of summary judgment seems to me to be an important thing.
So I think the court was absolutely right on the motion for summary judgment. And let's talk about the standards on a 60.02 motion. There's four of them, all right? And there really isn't any dispute about the last two, as there is in many cases. And so they're in all of the cases that we've seen and that we've discussed in our briefing. The last two factors are rarely, rarely looked at too hard. And they weren't in this instance either. But the first two factors are pivotal. And you got to think about what's going on here with the Rule 60 motion to go directly at your question. Well, do we look at whether summary judgment was proper? We do, because the Rule 60 motion says you got to have a reasonable defense on the merits and a debatably meritorious claim. And the reason that that factor is there is because there's a futility consideration here. And so why would we proceed if to proceed is futile?
So the analysis for us is whether there were grounds to deny that summary judgment or not.
That's right, Your Honor. And so the issue is whether to proceed is futile. And then the second factor you look at the reasonableness of the excuse. And Your Honors were right to point at the cases that say it's not a one-factor test, it's a multi-factor test, and that the errors of an attorney are attributable to the client through agency theories, and the Cole case says so. And also further, that it is not a black letter rule applicable in any instance where if you find neglect on the attorney, the client is freed from that neglect and the Rule 60.02 motion is granted, because
isn't there a strong policy favoring allowing the client to have their day in court where the excuse is attributable solely to the attorney?
Well, a couple of things going on here. Yes, that is a strong policy. But the Rule 60.02 test is not a one-factor test. And the courts go to great length to talk about that, because they talk about the abuse of discretion standard, that even in instances where there's attorney's neglect, we're going to look at this on an abuse of discretion standard. And as a matter of fact, the cases are clear that the appellate courts step back because they don't think that they are well suited to that analysis, because the district court has the people in front of them. The district court has the evidence in front of it. And there is some weighing here that the district court does, because they're connected to it. So the appellate courts purposefully step back from that. That's why it's an abuse of discretion standard, not a de novo standard. And it says the district court is best able to make this determination. And in this instance, there were multiple affidavits submitted with regard to what the attorney did and what the attorney did not do. And so weighing all those issues, the district court said, hey, we've looked at all of this. We've listened to your arguments. We read your affidavits. And at the end of the day, the district court made a determination that it said, we just don't find that excusable neglect in this instance, not reasonable and not excusable. So there was a close examination done by a district court judge who had the people in front of him, read all the affidavits, considered the evidence before it, and so it's entitled to a strong deference from this court And the cases do make that clear. So, which is why I think we need to take a good look also at what was going on summary judgment. You know, this wasn't a case where...
We agree with you that the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion to vacate. Do you agree we still address the underlying appeal to the summary judgment order?
Well, sure, Your Honor, because the cases do make it perfectly plain that it's a four-factor test, all right? You got to get them all. They have to prove them all, which is why we say, hey, there's two problems here. So even if this court and even if the state and even if the policy of this state is to be sympathetic to attorneys who make mistakes and not foist that on the clients, you still have to ring the bell four times. You still have to go to the summary judgment analysis. And when you do that summary judgment analysis, you'll see that the district court was absolutely correct in making its summary judgment decision. And also, you see that what we're hearing now are equitable issues that simply weren't raised below.
Although raised in the answer, in the pleading, correct?
Well, let's see. Ambiguity in contracts, not raised below at all. Unconscionability was raised in, I think, in the pleading. But let's remember, you can't just go at the pleading on a summary judgment stage. You gotta show facts that are in evidence with regard to your allegations.
And your position is that doesn't change, and so that the appellant's burden in pursuing its motion to vacate was to, in fact, provide evidence creating a genuine issue of material fact, not just saying we've made these allegations that, if established, would be sufficient.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. You need to remember where we were in this litigation. This isn't an instance where there's a default judgment or an instance where, remember, there were a lot of these Rule 5 cases that we're talking about when the pocket complaints were deemed dismissed after a year, all right? So that's where the key cases really have been showing up. So those were instances where there wasn't, they're more like default situations where the court didn't have anything. But Your Honor's pointed out that in one of the cases where they said, hey, you know, you still have to show us through affidavits or documents or otherwise that there's an issue here that you can survive on, that you have a claim that you can survive on. So they looked at the affidavits and they looked at the contracts, because the one case was a dispute about whether I was terminated or whether I quit. And so this gets to Judge Riley's point about what's the record here that we're looking at. And importantly, the record here is completely undisputed. So in this instance, the pleadings themselves, you had documents attached to the pleadings, and you had answers which conceded the documents. And so they were all there for all of the operative decisions on summary judgment. So the lease was there. The guarantees were in the record and admitted. It was admitted that rent wasn't paid. It was admitted that there was a... eviction action, that the court issued an order on settlement in the eviction action that Your Honors are clearly aware of because we've seen the operative language so far this morning. It was admitted that they vacated. It was admitted that they didn't pay rent after they vacated.
Would your argument be different if, say, in support of the Rule 60 motion, appellants had submitted affidavits of the appellants that would support their arguments about unconscionability, equitable estoppel, the equitable claims?
Well, I don't think...
I understand they didn't, but, I mean, is that the failure here to produce competent evidence to withstand summary judgment?
Okay, so on the summary judgment side, it's plaintiff's claims and their counterclaims, right, And so those were disposed of just by virtually on the pleadings of alone and the readings of the statute where the statutory counterclaims didn't apply to a non-residential lease. So now we're only talking about these alleged pleas to equity that were out there. And Your Honor's right about unjust enrichment is an affirmative claim, not pled, waived, doesn't exist. The same thing with regard to equitable estoppel, affirmative defense, not pled, waived. But with regard to the equitable estoppel, we have evidence in the record that rebuts any possible claim for equitable estoppel because you got to have a promise and you got to have reasonable reliance. And what they're kind of looking at is this order on settlement, which is unambiguous. There was no other promise pled in the action, no affidavit.
How is that when you read the settlement agreement and the lease together, there is an ambiguity in terms of whether the lease was reformed by the settlement agreement, because the settlement agreement expected that they would vacate the premises and make a rent payment on May 1st, which they contend was intended to be the last rent payment.
Well, ambiguity's a question of law, all right? And the court found no ambiguity because the court, in its summary judgment ruling, considered the lease, considered the order on settlement, and Your Honor read it perfectly. The number one predominant, the most important term within the order on settlement is the parties stipulate and agree that they are settling only claims regarding the possession of the leased premises, and they neither release or waive any contract claims under the lease or the lease guarantees. That's an extremely important term because you got to remember the context, right? We're in an eviction action. There were claims for unpaid rent. There's claims for going forward problems. All those claims don't get to get touched.
No, it's just present possession.
Correct. So this agreement unambiguously says we're only going to resolve the possession issue here today because that's all we can resolve, and we're going to reserve the remaining claims under the lease and the lease guarantees. But the district court looked at that, and it made a decision in its summary judgment motion that these documents were unambiguous and they proceeded.
So is it your contention that the other paragraphs then, 2 through 8, relate to our terms of resolving the claim of possession, and they don't in any way modify the underlying lease?
That's correct. If you look at those terms, they were backward-looking because they were dealing with unpaid rent. And another thing you can do, remember, in an eviction action, you know, the tenant can come in and cure when they're paying with the payment of rent. So the backward-looking stuff, they were there to cure. We're going to make an agreement about getting out. And so that's all that happened there. We made an agreement about the possession of the premises, which involved the collection of back rent, which would, you know, is part of their cure at the eviction action. But that was all decided, that was reviewed and decided in fairly detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law issued by the district court in this action. I would also say, remember, when you're dealing with summary judgment, or even if you're dealing to try to prove a meritorious claim on a Rule 60 motion, the case law talks about you can't just sit on your pleadings. You got to come in with something more. You got to show us. And they didn't come in with anything more at all. They sat on their pleadings alone, and the cases are unambiguous about that, and the pleadings don't even support the arguments that you're hearing when you're standing here. So, for example, the unconscionability. They make a vague reference that the lease is unconscionable. So unconscionability is, you know, it's a difficult case. You have to prove a number of things, right? They offer nothing whatsoever on, well, whether it's a contract where no person in their senses, not under delusion, would make on the one hand, and no honest and fair person would accept on the other. They don't show you anything about substantive fairness or procedural fairness. Were there disparate bargaining power? Well, there wasn't, because these are two corporate entities. So that's not even there. It's belayed by the facts themselves. And the other thing is, you know, unconscionability rarely exists in commercial settings. This is a commercial setting. So they got to have something other than it's unconscionable. And they made no effort to do so on the Rule 60 motion. So consequently, Your Honors, we respectfully request that the district court decisions be affirmed in all respects. Thank you.
Ms. Perlmutter?
Thank you, Your Honors.
I would like to first address the statement that opposing counsel made, that the district court has the people in front of them, they have all of the information before them. Typically, that is the case. However, in this matter, our clients were not represented. They weren't represented in the motion for summary judgment hearing. They weren't able to proceed.
But at the Rule 60 hearing, they were represented.
Correct? That is correct.
And in the Rule 60 hearing, the counsel could have provided affidavits with evidence to support the defenses that were being claimed.
Trial counsel could have done that, yes. And trial counsel did.
That wasn't done.
That was not done.
I was just reviewing the affidavit that trial counsel submitted. Seems to go solely to the second factor.
Yes.
The Findon factors.
Yes. And I would point to the fact that there is a broader problem here. Beyond trial counsel's failings, trial counsel did provide enough information to satisfy that second factor of the Findon factors, and it wasn't found to be satisfied.
But he, well, I think the judge said I can't make a finding.
Correct.
Based on what I have. But trial counsel in the memo went through all of the equitable arguments that you've been making today, and yet the affidavit in support of the motion just goes to factor number two.
Correct. I believe that, well, I can't speak for trial counsel. What I can speak to is the fact that our clients were entitled to their day in court. They are entitled to have their case heard on the merits, even if the merits aren't considered to be strong, even if there are issues with the defenses. They're still allowed to be heard. If they survive summary judgment. And I would argue that they should be heard on summary judgment. If this is reversed and remanded and opposing counsel wants to bring another motion for summary judgment, I would like our clients to be able to make meaningful and considered arguments to flesh out their defenses, to make the arguments. Obviously, you know, you can't just rest on the pleadings, as opposing counsel noted. And not resting just on the pleadings means being able to rely on an attorney's argument at a hearing.
Another concern I have in this case is this case was placed into the ELT program that by design is supposed to expedite and make litigation more efficient, which is why during the case management hearing, the court may not have given attorneys the actual date for summary judgment, but as I understand the record, Respondent's counsel made it very clear, we are going to be filing a motion for summary judgment, and presumably the case management order set a deadline for any such motions to be heard. I'm concerned that if we provide the relief you're seeking, that we undermine that process. The expedited process.
I have not seen the case management order. I was not provided that document in the record from trial counsel. I will note that while there are certainly considerations about expediting lawsuits, and that is an important policy, it's also important for clients' cases to be heard on the merits rather than summarily decided because of, trial counsel's failure to you know, practice law in an efficient way. Our clients should not be punished for policy considerations. They should be allowed to have their case proceed on the merits and at least be heard in court. They're entitled to their day in court. They're entitled to fully defend their case. Whether or not that defense fails or not, they are entitled to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. And our next case is going to be heard by ITV, and that needs to be set up, so we will be taking a short recess.